This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
If I do my job perfectly, I will probably kill you.
That's Shep Gordon. His job is managing musicians and chefs, turning them into stars. His clients want to be famous, but Gordon has learned fame can kill. After intentionally staying out of the spotlight himself throughout his career, Gordon is now the subject of a new documentary, directed by Mike Myers, called Supermensch, The Legend of Shep Gordon. Mike Myers and Shep Gordon are my guests. Mike Myers wrote and starred in the Austin Powers movies and Wayne's World and was the voice of Shrek. He was a cast member of Saturday Night Live from 1989 to 95. Shep Gordon not only managed the career of Alice Cooper, he was instrumental in creating the persona and dreaming up some of the stage antics that made Alice famous. Gordon has also managed Anne Murray, Blondie, Teddy Pendergrass, Luther Vandross, and briefly, George Clinton. He's often credited with creating the recent celebrity chef phenomenon. Mike Myers and Shep Gordon have been friends for about 22 years. Mike Myers, Shep Gordon, welcome to Fresh Air. Mike, let's start with you. How did you meet Shep Gordon?
I met Shep Gordon in 1992 on the set of Wayne's World. Shep Gordon, of course, is Alice Cooper's manager. And I wanted Alice Cooper to be in the film. And my two favorite songs were 18 and School's Out. Now, I had never even been in a film, let alone, like, written or being, like, one of the guys in the film. And Lorne said, well, you know, there's a little bit of a problem. You have to talk to his manager, Shep Gordon. I'm going, oh, okay. And so now I'm talking to this huge, legendary rock and roll manager, and he says, I've got some bad news for you. We're not going to do 18 again, and we're not doing School's Out. We're going to do something from the new album. And I was like, oh, no. I didn't know what to do. Now, Shep had like a ponytail, and he was wearing a satin tour jacket. And I didn't know what to do, and I said, well, I don't want to do that. And he said, well, I happen to know you start filming in 2 weeks. You don't have a choice. And he goes, you know, this song, I would hate for you to say no to this song and not have heard this song. And he played it, and I liked it. It was a song called Feed My Frankenstein. And I said, but, you know, that's not what I wanted in the script. You know, I didn't know nothing. I'm an idiot from Toronto. He said, I also happen to know this, that Alice will be on stage for approximately 8 seconds. And if you put School's Out in the end credits, people are going to think that's the song that he sang. And everyone thinks that that's the song he sang. He was absolutely right. Years later, I'm in Maui. The movie came out, and it was a hit, like a big hit. I had no idea. I didn't even know what a hit would look like. And so somebody told me you have to stay in a hotel with an assumed name. I had an assumed name, like a fake name. And only my brother Paul would call through. Phone rings, and I go, hey, Paul. And it's like, it's Shep Gordon. I understand you're in Hawaii, where Shep lives. I go, how did you get my number? He goes, it's Hawaii. He goes, do you want to go to a luau with Sylvester Stallone and Arnold? First of all, Arnold, not Arnold Schwarzenegger. Arnold and Whoopi. And I yeah, of course. So I went, and we've become fast friends.
So Shep Gordon, let me get to you. The movie starts, Supermensch starts, with a clip that we just heard where you say, if I do my job well, it will kill you. That's what you tell your new clients. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think fame is, you know, in some ways it's fool's gold. I think Mike really describes it the best of anyone I've heard. He calls it a toxic waste product of fame. And it truly is, you know. It's
the toxic, I always say it's the industrial disease of creativity.
Yeah.
Like, you want to make stuff, which is fantastic, and then this thing happens, which is very gratifying, and I'm very grateful for it, but it does require a hazmat suit, a psychic hazmat suit.
I had an interesting moment, because I've never had to deal with fame. I have only had to talk about it and try and protect people who are famous, and that's very different than living that moment. Until, you know, there's those old sayings, until you walk in the shoes, you don't really know the walk. And I have no true experience, but I had one moment during this process that really opened my eyes. I was walking to a meeting at the Algonquin Hotel, And I was doing what normal human beings do when they walk. They're in their own mind. They're thinking. They're maybe looking at stuff. They're maybe singing a song. But they're walking their path. And a girl I heard say, "Are you Shep? Are you Shep Gordon?" And I said, "I am." She said, "Oh, I work at CNN, and I just saw the movie at a screening." And when I was a child, I had some problems with my family, and I'd really love to talk to you about how you overcame those feelings and were successful. And I looked at my watch, and I had to go to the Algonquin. And I really wanted to be compassionate with this person, and I had to dish her. And it made me think about all those years I've spent protecting people from people like her, making sure they couldn't ask the question, never really thinking about what is the karmic price that the person in the middle who you're blocking for really feels. Because on some level, even if it's not conscious, they have to feel that love coming at them from people and not being able to answer it. It's really hard to stay compassionate. And I only had it for a second. So those are hard things. Those are things that fame bring that have no intrinsic value.
That's a really interesting point that you just made, that if you're famous and everybody wants to talk to you or confess to you or just be near you, it's hard to be compassionate because it's mathematically impossible to allow everybody to have that access to you.
How many times I've been with Alice where someone told them about the first concert they went to and they had to sneak out of their house, and they love telling them the story. It makes them feel good. It brings back memories. You don't want to cut them off, but Alice could hear that 24 hours a day and never be able to have a thought in his mind.
Yeah.
So he needs someone like me who protects him, but there's a price you pay.
You didn't grow up with the idea of like, and then I'll be a manager and manage all these music stars and celebrity chefs. You kind of happened into it. Your first career lasted, it sounds like, about 24 hours.
Yeah, a little less.
A little less, yeah. As a parole officer in a youth detention center just outside of L.A., and as the movie tells the story, you know, after you failed at that immediately, you go to L.A., you stop at this hotel, and at the hotel are people like Janis Joplin and Jimi Hendrix. And what I think I understood from the movie is that basically you had a lot of marijuana with you and you were selling the marijuana. And it was through selling a lot of marijuana that you kind of became people's not only dealer but also their manager. Do I have that right? Did I interpret that correctly?
Well, close. You have the pieces right. I had a fairly good business as a dealer to the celebrities in the hotel who were users. And they felt that I needed to have a legitimate business. In where the Chambers brothers and Jimi Hendrix came from, the ghettos, if you had a new watch on, you had to tell the police, where'd you get the watch? Long Island, nobody asked or cared. So I never really thought about that. So Jimmy said one day, what's your real job? And I don't really have a job. And he said, you Jewish? And in my background, when someone asks you that question, you start running. But I knew he was faster than me, so I just sort of said, yeah, I am, and had no idea that that would be the luckiest moment of my life. Because, you know, you're Jewish, you should be a manager. Because I guess, you know, all the studios, all the agencies were all notoriously run by Jews who didn't have the greatest reputations, but nonetheless, that's what they did. And as Alice tells it, Willie Chambers or Lester Chambers came over. Alice Cooper was living in their house. And said, we found the Jew that'll manage it. I think he might pay you also. And I was willing to pay him because it was a front. So they were a business expense.
Wait, so who did you pay so that you can manage them?
I paid
Cooper?
Alice $10 a week
to
say I was his manager.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Mike Myers and Shep Gordon, and Myers has just made a film about Shep Gordon. It's called Supermensch, and Shep Gordon is this, like, super manager and who's did things brilliantly behind the scenes to create fame for the people who he managed. And those people include Alice Cooper, Anne Murray, Teddy Pendergrass, Blondie, Luther Vandross.
Groucho Marx,
yes. Of course, right, Groucho Marx was already famous.
Yes, of course.
Definitely.
Yes.
This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guests are Mike Myers and Shep Gordon. Mike Myers has made a new documentary about Shep Gordon. It's called Supermensch. And it's about Shep Gordon and his work as a manager, doing things behind the scenes that were kind of brilliant to help create fame for the people who he managed, including Alice Cooper and Murray. He managed Teddy Pendergrass, Blondie, Luther Vandross. And it's really an incredible behind-the-scenes look into fame, how fame is constructed, and what happens when you become famous. When I interviewed Alice Cooper in 2007, I was really surprised and pleased at how aware he was of constructing the persona of Alice Cooper and how he saw it as a vaudeville act. And within the interview, he, of course, credited you as well, you know, for creating the whole Alice Cooper persona. And having seen the movie about you, Shep Gordon, the movie Supermensch, now I really understand exactly how that was constructed, the Alice Cooper persona, and how much you contributed to that. And you knew that the way to get attention was to be seen as a rock act that was dangerous and that adults really hated and that therefore young people could really embrace. So
I would say knew is maybe too strong a word. Hoped would probably be a much better word.
So what's an example of one of your favorite things that you did to make Alice Cooper seem dangerous?
I think everything we did, you have to remember the times. We're talking now about the early 70s, late 60s. So first think about a man named Alice. That was very, very, very bold. There was nothing like that on the landscape. Then think about a man named Alice in makeup and dresses. That's way bolder. Then think about that person who could be your neighbor next door. It could be a 60-year-old widow named Alice Cooper wearing that dress, chopping up a baby doll on stage and having snakes and eating chickens. So everything we did went to that point. I would say the highlight of his career was the chicken incident because it really revolted everybody. There was nobody who wanted anyone to ever kill a chicken.
Okay, so
as Alice says, why don't they pick on Colonel Sanders? I only killed one chicken.
Okay, let's back up for a second. So the chicken story starts with you getting Alice Cooper placed on a rock festival when he wasn't yet very well known. You got him placed in between, was it the Doors and John Lennon?
Yeah, it was an amazing moment. It was John Lennon wanted to do something on his own. He really was an amazing human being. I would say of every musical artist that I've been near in my life, he was the most dedicated to using his power to really helping the planet more than anyone I've ever met. And he really felt that a peace concert changed people's lives significantly. I was there. I saw it. So to be able to put Alice on that show, I knew would revolt everybody. This was the perfect moment in life, and it worked perfectly. As Alice says, what should have destroyed a career made a career. And all of a sudden, he became the Salvador Dali of rock and roll.
So the way he described it when I interviewed him is like he's on stage at this concert in between the Doors and John Lennon, and suddenly there's a chicken on stage, and he says, you know, I didn't bring it. I don't know how it got there. So you brought the chicken?
I did.
What were you thinking?
I was thinking exactly that here's a peace concert. Somehow this chicken's going to get in serious trouble if it's on the stage. And it's got to be so juxtaposed position to what this whole concert was about that people had to hate him for doing it. And hatred is what we wanted.
So I'm laughing because this is a hysterical story, but it really was unfair to the chicken. What happened was Alice Cooper takes the chicken, throws it into the audience, and then the audience starts tearing the chicken apart, which really sounds horrifying.
Yeah, pretty horrifying. Yeah.
But there wasn't a part of you that felt bad, oh, my God, this poor chicken, and oh, what am I bringing out in these kids? I mean, not to dwell on this, but tearing apart a chicken isn't exactly like, you know, protesting the war in Vietnam.
I had a real epiphany because, as Alice always talks about, I end up writing the shows for the most part. And I never could quite understand why I always wrote these shows. Why the chopping up the baby dolls, exactly why. And I went to in Bali to a small village. And they did what they described to me as a tribal dance that they've been doing for generations. And it was the Alice show. which blew my mind. So I started reading. But when I say the Alice show, a guy from the village, all the village starts dancing. One guy in the village gets black on his eyes. He starts killing the other villagers. He starts killing animals. The village goes into a trance. They're all on the ground.
When you say killing other villagers, this is a pantomime
ritualistically.
Thing.
Ritualistically. The entire community's down. He's the only one standing. And then they rise up, and they kill him. And he comes back without the eye makeup, dressed in white, which is exactly the Alice shows. Alice does these despicable crimes. He's always dressed in black. He does the worst things you can do to society. He chops up baby dolls. He kills chickens. He molests snakes. He spits on people. He's disgusting. And he almost wins. He beats up the nurse. He knocks out the cop. He has, you know, he's killing everybody. And all of a sudden, they all come together and they either bring him to a guillotine or they bring him to a hanging. Somehow they kill him. The town rises up, kills him. He comes back dressed in white, reborn, doing schools out. But when I look back at it and I saw that play, I realized, wow,
You're tapping into something.
Yeah, it's really tribal. It's really hitting a nerve that's way beyond even us in our writing ever thought about.
Shep Gordon, you've used the word vaudeville to describe Alice Cooper's act. And Alice Cooper has used that word to describe his act. Groucho Marx had used that word to describe Alice Cooper's act. He became a fan. You ended up managing Groucho Marx in his final years. Mike Myers, when you as an Alice Cooper fan realized that, oh, this is such a constructed act. It is kind of vaudeville. You know, Shep Gordon is kind of, you know, writing the act. Did that make you like Alice Cooper even more? Or did you feel like betrayed, like, oh, it's not authentic?
Oh, I liked him even more. See, I loved the theatricality of it. I knew it to be the burlesque of violence. You know what I'm saying? A filmmaker that I worship is Quentin Tarantino.
And you were in Inglourious Basterds.
I was in Inglourious Basterds. I got the call one day. I thought it was my brother Paul, who does fantastic voices. And it was like Tarantino. And I'm like, yeah, can I help you? Yeah, I'm doing a film about Hitler gets killed. Do you want to play a British general explaining the mission? And I was like, am I being punked? Of course I want to play a British general. Are you kidding? Both my parents were in, my mom was in the Royal Air Force. My dad was in the Royal Engineers. I'm totally in. So I went back, just because I love his films, I looked at all of the films and I just thought, you know, there are certain people who should be allowed to do Grand Guignol because they take it to such a fantastic, absurd level. Alice Cooper is one of them, you know.
I want you to tell, Shep Gordon, I want you to tell a little bit of the Anne Murray story. She's just so the opposite of Alice Cooper. She's, you know, a pop singer who has a kind of, you know, middle-of-the-road-ish sensibility. Her most famous recording, Snowbird. So what was your plan to make her famous?
I was managing Alice. We were getting successful. None of us knew why. I had opportunities to expand my management business, but I had no idea if I was a manager. There wasn't a rule book. There wasn't a handbook. And I thought, let me go as far away as I possibly can. When I was in Toronto at John Lennon, I had met a producer named Brian Ahern, who had just cut a song called Snowbird with Anne Murray. She was a gym teacher from, I believe, Nova Scotia, and she worked on a summer TV show. And it was a good challenge because it was the opposite of Alice. It was a pure singer. There were no frills, no story, no anything. It was as unblemished as you could possibly get, unmanufactured. And it worked. We got her some pictures with John Lennon and Alice, and she had a great voice. And
set that up. You made it.
I did, yeah.
You
I
invited got, John Lennon and other people to be
Alice
at the club where she was performing. Yeah. Yeah.
Alice had a group called the Hollywood Vampires who met at the Rainbow Bar and Grill. And it
but by the way, Shep, when you say a group, you mean a drinking club.
A drinking club, yes. A drinking club, very, very heavy drinking club. It was Alice, John Lennon, Keith Moon, Harry Nilsson, all of whom knew how to drink, Mickey Dolenz, and Bernie Taupin. And they met at the Rainbow every night and would get as drunk as they could. And Keith Moon would come dressed as a nurse one night, as a Nazi general the next night, as a chauffeur the next night. It was insane. And I went over and I begged them to come see Anne Murray at the Troubadour for a picture. And I think I ended up having to drive each of them for the next 3 or 4 months. I was a designated driver, but they came over, took a picture, and that picture went everywhere.
See, Shep's theory is this idea of guilt by association. Shep said, how I can help Anne Murray is get her on the Midnight Special. How I can get her on the Midnight Special is get her photographed with someone like John Lennon. He begged, borrowed, steal, got them to the Troubadour. They took a picture. The picture went around the world. She got booked to the Midnight Special, and she crossed over. And she was on in Rolling Stone, and sales, as Shep says, sales went off the roof.
Yes.
He means through the roof.
Yeah, right.
That's a Shepism.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Mike Myers and Shep Gordon. Myers directed the new documentary about Gordon called Supermensch, The Legend of Shep Gordon. Mensch is a Yiddish word meaning a person of integrity and honor. Gordon is a manager whose clients have included Alice Cooper, Anne Murray, Teddy Pendergrass, Blondie, and George Clinton. He's also often credited with starting the celebrity chef phenomenon. Mike Myers wrote and starred in the Austin Powers and Wayne's World films and is a former cast member of Saturday Night Live. When we left off, Shep Gordon was talking about how he helped make Anne Murray famous by staging a group photo with her and John Lennon, Harry Nilsson, Mickey Dolenz, and Alice Cooper. So, Shep Gordon, does it make you kind of cynical about the public to know that the way to make somebody famous is to stage a photo? And people will actually think, oh, that must mean that she's hip. Now I want to hear her.
You know,
hearing the music isn't going to be enough, that you have to do that kind of stuff and that people will eat it up.
Right. I have a very different fix on that. And I think one of the dangers that I talk about is that fame now has become fame for fame's sake. So maybe that's possible now. But when I was doing it, it was really to put a spotlight on someone with true, real talent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm sure John Lennon was in pictures with a lot of people. Anne Murray deserved the spotlight. I knew that if I could get a spotlight on her, if they heard her on Midnight Special, she was the real deal. You know, I never tried to fool the public. I kept a sense of integrity. I wouldn't take somebody who I didn't think had talent. And it's really just the jump start. Annie built a career without, you know, John Lennon didn't follow her career. And it's been an amazing 35-year career. So I look at more as a spotlight than I do as a trick.
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
I think the audience, there's so much information out there. The audience deserves and needs to have someone put a light on what really is good.
Shep also loves artists. That's the thing that why I have been worshiping Shep for so many years and love him so much. He refuses to gossip. I will hear a piece of something. I'm not a big gossiper either. I do think it's one of the sins, by the way. And I will hear something of somebody he knows, and unconsciously I will say, did you hear about blank and the blank? And Shep gets quiet, and he looks at his hands, and I go, you don't want to talk about this, do you? And he'll go, you know, I just think there's more positive things to talk about. This is the guy who knows. He knows everything about everyone. He's human. He's sodium pentothal in human form. He knows everything about everyone and refuses to talk, which is why everybody loves him. You're safe, dude.
Do you see that as part of your walking job, Shep, to like keep people secrets?
Yeah, absolutely. I think. I don't look at it as keeping people's secrets at all.
Privacy.
Yeah, just
dignity.
Yeah, dignity.
Mm-hmm.
Respect.
So let's talk about Teddy Pendergrass a little bit, because you started managing him after he went solo following his time with Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes. And you tell this great story about how he performed and one night when you started managing him and didn't get paid, and it was really hard for you to collect the money, and you were kind of shocked by this. Would you tell the story?
Yeah, there was a circuit, as I later found out, called the Chitlin Circuit, which is pretty famous in the world of R&B and black music. And it was a circuit of clubs and arenas in the major markets of America that were, for the most part, owned by the radio station in the city or had some relationship with the radio station. And black artists would go into these rooms and play, The record company would set it up. They wouldn't get paid, but they thought that was the only way they could get the radio station to play their song, was to play the club. I'm sure it was a form of payola that someone figured out. There was no money exchanging hands, so the government couldn't bust them or something. But what happened was this mentality of accepting the fact that they weren't getting paid. And that didn't work for me. And Teddy was very big at the time, and he was, you know, he took a real chance. He trusted me, and we went out to break the circuit, and it was scary. This movie is 90 minutes, so you can't tell everything.
Right.
But the night at the Roxy that we talked about, there were death threats by him. The FBI was everywhere around the place. It was the first time we played at Whitehall, and the first time we said we were going to break this Chitlin circuit. And it was scary, but we got through.
Why were there death threats? Where were they coming from?
A lot of people made a lot of money off the Chitlin circuit. It was very big business, and it was not, it was a time of gangsterism in the music business. A lot of Italian mob, a lot of Afro-American mob. A lot of people went to jail during that era for a lot of stuff that wasn't friendly. And this was big business. I mean, you know, we sold out Radio City Music Hall. We had probably 1,000 pickets outside. There were organized pickets against there was no legitimate reason for a black man not to play Radio City Music Hall except that he was getting paid.
What did the picket sign say?
Union unfair. I don't even remember. I'm sure there's pictures of it, but it was
completely trumped up.
Yeah, completely trumped up. But it was big business. This was, you know, the Chitlin Circuit was very big business. I think fairly well documented. And it was a couple of acts. I remember Earth, Wind, and Fire came in right on the back of us and started playing places like Madison Square Garden, Donna Summer. There was we weren't the only ones to break, but I think Teddy was the first one to really stand up. His past manager had been shot to death. So he had a position to he had a strong platform to speak from.
Well, that must have scared you a little bit, no?
It all scared me, but again, it wasn't, you know, I don't know how to describe it. I'd wake up in the morning, do what I do, go to sleep. If someone killed me, they killed me. It wasn't part of the fabric.
But also with Shep, you know, Shep's a hippie.
Yeah.
It's that fantastic era of people who really did want to change the world. And that's been Shep's MO from day one, is looking at something. And you know, he's very, very sensitive to injustice.
You have to do something. It's one person at a time. You have to do something.
In 1982, when Teddy Pendergrass was in a car accident and became quadriplegic, you were the one who had to tell him that he was paralyzed and would never walk again. Why were you the one who had to deliver that news?
You know, that's my memory. And as a movie shows, sometimes my memory is jaded. So I don't want to write in stone 100%. My memory of it is I got off the elevator. He had nobody significant in his life at that time. His mother was very old, but he didn't have a wife. The children were too young. And it was a very tough thing to tell somebody. And I was sort of the father figure, manager. I was more than just manager in Teddy's life. We had our lives threatened. When your life is threatened with someone, you go to a different place when you get through it. Mm-hmm. It's almost like soldiers in a battlefield. You can't describe what that bond is, but there's a bond that's different than a manager-client bond, and we had that. I remember I told him, and then we went right to his house and started listening. I said to his mother, and we got to go out to the house and find tapes that haven't been released because we're going to need money. And he had spent every dime he had. And we went from the hospital to the house and found some songs that had never been released that were sitting around the living room, and then tracked it out, and that's got the record out.
Oh.
But it was not my favorite moment.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Shep Gordon and Mike Myers. Mike Myers of Saturday Night Live and Austin Powers fame has made a documentary about his longtime friend, Shep Gordon, who is a longtime manager of such people as Alice Cooper, Teddy Pendergrass, Anne Murray, Blondie, George Clinton, And the documentary is called Supermensch, The Legend of Shep Gordon. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Mike Myers of Saturday Night Live, Wayne's World, and Austin Powers fame, and Shep Gordon, a manager who helped make a lot of his clients famous. Myers' new documentary about Gordon is called Supermensch. I want to get back to what you say at the very beginning of Supermensch, Shep Gordon. You say that you always told your clients, you would say to them, if I do my job, it's going to kill you, implying that fame can be very, very dangerous. Did you ever have regrets about making somebody famous, seeing how they were changed by fame and how fame maybe hurt their lives?
Yeah, every time. My job was to be honest, and this is how I made my living. But I knew I would hurt him, and it, especially when you become friendly, which didn't happen with every client. But when they become your friend, you know, when I saw Alice having going through his alcoholism, that was so painful, and I knew I was a big part of it. But I was honest with him, and, you know, he could have maybe gotten it through someone else who wouldn't have cared, and then the pain could really hurt. So I just, you know, I made excuses to myself for how I made a living and tried to do it as honorably as I could. But I can't say that I'm proud of, you know, if I had to rewrite history, I'd love to get that part of what I did for my life out of the way, but they go hand in hand. If you make someone famous, they have to pay a price.
Did you pay any of the prices of fame, even though your name wasn't famous, but you were constantly surrounded by famous people, people who you helped make famous?
No, I think I think most of my pain was probably self-inflicted, in that I used my work as an excuse to not have to deal with my personal life. It became a very easy way to not have a life, mm-hmm. and not have to deal with all those big issues that having a life can bring.
I can't do that now. I'm too busy. That
exactly.
kind of thing.
Yeah. 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 It was a useful tool.
Well, you know, it's funny, in the movie you talk about how, you know, you really regret that you don't have any children. You'd love to have a baby. You were married and then divorced. You wanted a child, didn't work out. So now I think after this movie, you're going to get all these women contacting you, I think, saying that they want to have a baby with you.
Like, right,
you
know, I am.
Are you expecting right. that to happen? That's going to be, I'm serious, and that's going to be kind of odd.
It's been happening at the screenings, and it's...
seriously?
It's odd, but it's wonderful. I mean, it's, you know, I've tried to take it in a really positive, good way and pay attention to each one of them and just be honest about it, but it is...
So what do you say, you know, when you're being honest?
There's a lot
about
of people
it.
Like me out there looking to have a child. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of lonely people, you know, it's the nature of our society.
Consider yourself lonely?
Yeah, at times I do. Yeah, absolutely. Not unhappy. I'm happy almost every day. I'm really lucky. But there are times I'm definitely lonely.
So 2 weeks into this documentary being made, the documentary about you, Supermensch, you nearly died. What happened?
I had what they call a heart attack of the stomach, which is, I guess, a cholesterol blocker. But it's... more dangerous than a heart attack because it's hard to diagnose and hard to find. So only a lucky few get through, and I was one of the lucky few.
Did you know what was going on? Did you think you were
no,
dying?
No, not at all. I was completely, you know, it's funny. I've had a few diseases that I knew about, and those moments are amazing. When you face your mortality in the mirror is so scary, and so it brings up, I mean, it really is. What a moment. And I've had cancer and I've had some stents and I've had those moments. In this one, I had pain and passed out. And truthfully, if I hadn't come back, it would have been okay. I love cooking. And they talk about when a fish gets hooked, it releases a poison in its system, just like any animal, an adrenaline. They release adrenaline at that moment of death. And I sort of felt like if it had happened, if I hadn't come through my stents or my cancer, I probably would have had that in my body. But on this particular journey, I was completely at peace. I could have been eaten well.
Mike Myers, I'm wondering what was going through your mind when Shep nearly died, because he's not only the subject of the documentary that you had just started, he's also a dear friend.
He's a dear friend. I mean, you know, I had worked so long to get him to say yes. Literally, he would say to people, yeah, Mike wants to do this movie. Is that crazy? Is that crazy that he wants to do this movie? And Shep kept texting me going, is this ego? He was playing golf, and I get a text from Hawaii. Is this ego? And I go, no, Shep. It's legacy, and it's a legacy you deserve. You're responsible. You're the Lamaze birth coach of so much culture that people need to know that. And the other thing, too, is you're a lovely human being who's managed to make a fantastic living and still maintain his humanity. But, of course, 2 weeks into the filming, I get the call from his fantastic assistant, Nancy Miola, who's this fantastic, beautiful person. And she said, Shep is in a coma. I don't know if he's going to make it. And I cried. But because I grew up in a house where my parents are from Liverpool, I turned to my wife, Kelly, and I said, we have our ending.
Yeah, see, I was just going to say good for ticket sales.
which is, you have to do that. Then when something horrible happened, my dad would say, all right, how fast can we find this funny?
Oh, wow. But you hadn't shot enough to have a film, let alone an ending.
No, I just gathered stuff, wanted to do it, got a question list. I was like, what?
But did you have to decide, like, when it was clear, like, he was going to pull through, like, were you going to bring the cameras into the hospital room and interview him as he's starting to regain his health? You know,
Shep is made out of the stuff that they should make airplanes out of. He can't be killed by conventional weapons. And so his recovery was like, he was like doing handsprings within 3 weeks. They cut him open like a fish, and they like pulled out yards and yards and yards of his intestines. And then I said, so Shep, listen, dude, I love you. I'm so glad you're well. If you don't want to do this, that's fine. And in Shep's, because he's a man of few words, often he goes, oh, no, I'm okay. I'm like, oh, okay. Yeah, it'll be a couple of weeks. What are you kidding? A couple of weeks? You know what I mean? I hurt my wrist playing hockey, and I was like, stop the world. And he's like, they cut him open, literally like had parts of him here and parts of him there, and he's like, yeah, I should be back in a couple of weeks. And he was. The guy's a horse. I couldn't believe it. And I said to him, I said, Shep, you died. He did. He died on the table.
He flatlined?
And I said, you know, because I'm obsessed with all that stuff, you know. I said, dude, you left. And why do you think you came back? And he said, you know what? I don't really think of it as an I came back situation. I'm not really attached that much. And he's not. I would be telling everybody. I'd be like, if I got into a cab, I'd go, yeah, can I go to 42nd and 8th, please? Did I ever tell you about the time I died? But Shep was like, you know. No, Shep was like, yeah, I never really thought of it that way. He's a true Jubu.
Jewish Buddhist.
He's a Jewish Buddhist, right. Yeah. He's a self-described Jubu.
So if you're just joining us, I have two guests. Mike Myers, who is an alum of Saturday Night Live and, of course, the Austin Powers films, directed a new documentary about his dear friend, Shep Gordon. Shep Gordon is a manager who has come up with, like, brilliant publicity schemes and many other ways of helping to bring fame to his clients and then protecting them once they become famous. Those clients include Alice Cooper, Anne Murray, Teddy Pendergrass, Blondie, George Clinton for a while, Luther Vandross.
Oh, yeah. I love George Clinton.
Yeah. So the documentary is called Supermensch. So Mike Myers had been saying that during the period when he was trying to convince you to do the movie, you were going to do it, but you also had second thoughts about it. You would be texting him like, is this ego? And I'm thinking, you know, you've met the Dalai Lama. You know a lot about Buddhism. And that's all about, you know, not being ego.
Right.
And fame is so bound with ego. And it seems, you know, like one of those great paradoxes that, you know, you're embracing Buddhism, but also have been so much a part of, like, the fame machine.
Mm-hmm.
And have had to deal with so much ego.
Yeah, I think There's not a lot in my life that makes sense. But I think there, you know, the beautiful thing about Buddhism is that it's all perfect. There's no judgments at all. Never to be judgmental. Just be compassionate. If fame is what someone wants, and you explain to them what the price is for it, and you can help them achieve what they want, even if you know there's a heavy price to pay, that's very much within the realm of what a good Buddhist, I think, would do. I don't know. I'm not a practicing Buddhist. But I think...
You're a living Buddhist, though, dude. You're not even attached to consistency.
So, yeah, no, I don't think... I think they work hand in hand. And I think in some ways, fame has been fantastic for His Holiness because it's brought the plight of His people to the public awareness. Without His fame, it would never have... people would not be enlightened about the problem.
Did you help him with that? Did you help him?
No, I don't think so. I mean, maybe in a small way, in some mm-hmm. subtle way. Mm-hmm. I did a lot of events with them and maybe guided some things, but I wouldn't take any credit for it at all.
Now, some managers are famous, and I'm thinking about Ari Emanuel and Entourage, the show that's kind of loosely based on him.
Uh-huh.
I'm sure you would have had that opportunity if you wanted it to be a name like that. You know, you are so not famous outside of that world. You don't have a Wikipedia entry. In fact, when I found out, wait, really, when I found out you didn't have a Wikipedia entry, my first reaction was, oh no, the film's actually a mockumentary and not a real documentary. The whole thing's made up. And then, no, really. And then I actually,
that's great.
I went and made sure that there were other sources earlier on that cited you. I checked you out on my on my interview with, you know, with Alice Cooper, and he'd mentioned you, and I thought, like, phew, okay, it's not a mention. This guy's real.
Yeah, I think my job is accomplished much better if I'm invisible.
Mm-hmm.
I in a compassionate way. I don't mean this in a degrading way, but I always thought of myself as a puppeteer, but in a good way. But always, you know, you don't want to see the puppeteer. It takes away from the power of the performance. That was always, I felt my job was to not, was great for, you know, I never wanted to be in the pictures. I never wanted to be in, you know, it's funny because there are moments now, having gone through this, where I wish I had taken a picture with Salvador Dali. Mm. And I went way out of my way not to.
So imagine like doing a documentary on somebody who's one of the most famous people that nobody knows. He's show business famous, famous to the famous, and having virtually no photographs of him with any of these people. And I'm like, dude, a Polaroid?
Something.
A court reporter sketch? You know, help me out, people. But we did find stuff, yeah, you know. Yeah, we had great
researchers.
You did
an amazing job. Mike did an amazing job.
And our editor, yeah. Joe Krings, is fantastic. Yeah. Just a genius. So that we truffle pigged you out, dude, and found stuff.
Yeah,
we
really
hunted you down like the animal you
stuff
are.
Stuff I had never seen.
Yeah.
So it sounds like... That Mike Myers making this movie about his dear friend Shep Gordon did not hurt the friendship.
Strengthened it if it could get stronger. I don't know if it can get stronger, but if anything, strengthened.
No, I love Shep going into this, and then as I came to know more and more about him, I love him even more. And yeah, he's a friend of the family. Like he's, you know, when my daughter Sunday was born, I was just thinking, oh. Geez, I wonder when Shep's coming to town.
For me, to entrust my life to someone is way beyond even friendship. And I didn't see it till Mike finished it, but I knew it would be what it should be.
It was a really good film. I thank you both so much for talking with us. Shep Gordon, Mike Myers, thank you both so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Mike Myers' new documentary about Shep Gordon is called Supermensch. We have an interview extra for you. It's the story of how Shep Gordon introduced George Clinton to the Dalai Lama. That's on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/freshair.